So I specifically sought out roles where I could balance those deep technical skills with always moving closer to the business side of things. So that way I could eventually become the PM I am today, where I have a proven track record of delivering positive business outcomes, but I never lose touch with the technology, understanding things to the ground level, because if I didn't have that, I wouldn't have credibility to myself. So that's my niche. That way I can credibly say that I am an applied ML PM. I can understand what scientists are talking about, even though I know that they are much more qualified than I am.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Data Scientist Show. I'm Daliana. Today, we have Abhi Sharma. Abhi started his career as a software engineer at Amazon Lab 126, building cloud services for Alexa. Later, he transferred to Amazon Web Services as a deep learning architect. And guess what? We used to work at the same team at Machine Learning Solutions Lab at AWS. And currently, he's a product manager at Chime, responsible for machine learning products like chatbots. Today, we'll talk about how he transitioned his career from software engineer to deep learning architect and to product manager in machine learning, and cool project he worked on, our shared experiences at Amazon. So it will be a fun conversation. If you enjoy the show, subscribe to the channel, leave a comment, give us a 5-star review. And if you want to sponsor the podcast or have any ideas, feedback, send me a message on LinkedIn. Welcome to the show, Abhi.
Sounds great. Thank you, Daliana. Good to be with you.
How did you get into machine learning?
Yeah. So during my undergrad, I had the chance to take some graduate courses in machine learning, do a semester of research, get just enough exposure to realize that I found the field interesting in that with machine learning, if you focus on learning the fundamentals, you can actually apply those skills to quite a number of domains and have new innovations such as, say, generative models for new use cases, like even making art to nice predictions, that sort of thing. So I found it to be one of the most generalizable computer science subjects. As a lifelong generalist, appealed to me.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. So you started your career as a software engineer. How did you transition into deep learning architect? And for folks who are not familiar with this role, maybe you can also tell us what does it entail?
Sure. So when I joined Amazon Lab 126 out of college, I was on a core Alexa platform team that called several machine learning services. So that way I got some exposure to production ML workloads from that perspective, somewhat indirect. And from there, I learned more about it, realized that, oh, I find this space interesting. I would like to work more closely with the ML still in a production context, leverage the some of the background that I got. At the same time, I knew my limits relative to, say, PhDs, people with much more of a fundamental research background. Thought, okay, I can make niche for myself in more of this applied ML space. So with that in mind, also considering my interest in product management or doing work closer to the business while not losing touch with technical fundamentals, I found that it made sense to move internally within Amazon to a role where I could be closer to the business. So in AWS, I found an opening for a role called Deep Learning Architect, where there's this idea of solutions architecture, or in industry, it's like customer engineer, where in essence, these people with technical backgrounds work directly with external customers of their company to help teach them effectively how to use services in a specific technical area. So in that sense, they can help facilitate sales, work in a pre-sale context, that sort of thing. So I thought that that role would be interesting and would be a nice transition for me to move toward product management. So I found that role within AWS. I also wanted to see a different corner at Amazon, from Alexa to AWS. So I decided to make that transition. And while at AWS in that role, I was able to take product management responsibilities on customer ML projects for half that time. And that way transitioned fully to product management here in my role at Chime today.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. So previously I have talked to Alyssa Kim. She was also
our other former colleague.
Yeah, data scientist, research scientist on the team. And she described this experience at Machine Learning Solutions Lab as a MBA. She also works on data products right now. So I think it's a great team for folks who are in software engineering, data science, and transition into products. So how did you know you want to become a product manager?
So to be frank, my interests always lean more toward product management in that although I cared about technical details, understanding things at the root level, that's why I studied computer science, wanted to challenge myself. I was always more interested in business outcomes or shaping what to build mm-hmm. as opposed to figuring out how best to build something. So even out of college, I thought of going directly into product management, but I found that I had better opportunities in software engineering and that I could get a more solid technical foundation before moving to product management. Mm. Actually, in retrospect, that foundation is not necessarily essential to being a PM. There are many PMs that don't necessarily have the same level of technical background, but personally, I only feel comfortable if I can understand the domain I work on, even as a PM, to the root level. So while I'm glad I started as an engineer, I have that robust technical background, I don't think it necessarily helped me to become a product manager. Mm. In fact, you have to kind of jump through hoops to transition roles into product management as opposed to trying to start as a PM right out of college. So in fact, that path may be easier.
Mm-hmm. So can you share more details about how exactly you transitioned? Did you just wake up one day and talk to your manager, hey, I want to do some product management?
So it's never that quite linear, although for some people, they may have had different experiences. Yeah. In my case, since I was on a core backend team, it was already a bit far from customers. However, my team got a new charter about a year into my tenure there, where going from owning this core backend service, we had this new initiative to effectively reach a new customer base, enabling developers to control a new type of Alexa device through our service. So we did not have a PM, but we suddenly had a lot of new cross-team collaboration yeah. work. So I effectively, informally took on those PM responsibilities for my team, cross-team coordination, scoping, that sort of thing. And eventually a full-time PM was hired, but I helped that person ramp up. And so I effectively was acting as a PM for my team, spending even more time doing that yeah. than coding even. And so I was able to segue into that deep learning architecture for AWS with these more product-focused experiences.
Mm. Yeah.
In fact, I did try recruiting externally for product manager roles concurrently, but I found that with just 1 year of experience as an engineer, despite I was able to perform well in interviews, but just getting interviews in the first place was difficult.
Yeah.
So in general, it's very difficult to transition from one field to another until you can actually put a title on your resume saying that, oh, I was formerly a PM, at least for some portion of my time.
Yeah, that's a great point. So whenever you want to transition your career, try to leverage your current role, take on some actual responsibility. And I think Machine Learning Solutions Lab in AWS is a great place to transition because we didn't really have PM, like you mentioned. So when I was leading a project, I was not just a data scientist. I was also the program manager. I'm also the product manager to think about a strategy because you're not just building a model. You want your mm-hmm. customers to use your solution. So you have to adopt design thinking to figure out how mm-hmm. do the end users will adopt it. What are going to be their challenges? What are some use cases? And in our project cycle, which is quite short, usually 4 weeks, sometimes 3 or 6 months, there has to be multiple pivots. Mm-hmm. So that's a great training for you to adopt this thinking, how to think like a product manager.
Yeah. Although I would add the caveat that yeah. the engagement-driven work in ML Solutions Lab, like any consulting type of work, mm-hmm. is inherently short-termist or
yeah.
focused on immediate-term deliverables. You don't really get much experience managing long-term trade-offs, crafting a cohesive roadmap or long-term vision or selling that to upper management, defending choices, doing experimentation. I think in terms of, say, building a roadmap or a lot of those PM fundamentals, those you don't get exposure to in customer-facing roles. However, to Daliana's point, you can get exposure to working with customers, trying to scope into requirements, a lot of the initial product lifecycle steps, you can certainly get exposure from in any customer-facing role, like what you see at the ML Solutions Lab.
Right. So I think if you're familiar with the entire life cycle of the project, from talking to customers, understanding their use case, to model development, to putting models in production, talking to the user, it's a great place for you to decide which part of the data science or machine learning cycle do you enjoy more. And then you can decide whether you want to be a generalist, continue to do data science consulting, or be a specialist. For example, some people went on become a machine learning engineer, just focusing on the production part. And some people would be like you, really enjoy product management and become a product manager. So can you tell us more about what you do right now as a product manager? And what, for example, what's your day-to-day like at Chime?
Sure. And before that, I did want to comment on another aspect of customer-facing work in that it's a great way to get that generalist broad-based exposure like Daliana mentioned. One caveat is that if you want to do more cutting-edge basic research type work, you may have less scope to do that in customer-facing roles simply because the business needs take precedence and the project cycles, like 6 months at the maximum, don't always lend them to publication.
Yeah.
So it's almost as though you have to trade off between doing more fundamental research work on one hand versus on the other, trying different industries, getting that more broad-based exposure via consulting roles. So it's a matter of finding what the best fit for you is and then deciding accordingly. And the nice thing is that you can go between the two depending on your level of science background, fundamental math skills. So lots of choices to think about.
Yeah, that's a great point. So you need to decide, do you like the variety or you want to go deep in one domain, one vertical? I think that's also some data scientists' struggles. They feel they really like one subject, for example, computer vision or NLP, but they didn't have enough time to spend more time on it. But I think the benefit is on the team, our managers give us time to write papers. So that's another way for us to dive deeper in one subject. Yeah.
Yep. And also, even when you write papers, you can decide between publishing in core ML journals or at ML conferences versus trying to publish in industry-specific journals, like say the automotive industry or various life sciences publications. So even there you can choose between different domains versus core ML, that sort of thing. So that's another great aspect of ML in that since it's applicable to so many different fields, based on your own interests, if you start with some ML skills, you can choose in which direction you want to take them or how you want to apply yourself.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I would love to talk more about our shared experiences at Amazon and some projects you worked on. So going back to the previous question, so now you transition into product management. What is your day-to-day like?
Yeah, so at Chime, I have a more traditional B2C PM role where I'm responsible for the roadmap and execution for Chime's chatbot, IVR, which stands for Interactive Voice Response, or basically an automated phone system that I call into, as well as live chat. So those three main support channels for Chime, which is the leading neobank or banking app in the US. And so my days are basically composed of deciding in the long term what direction to take those products in, managing overall roadmap, with in the immediate term, balancing execution priorities, coordinating with, say, of course, ML scientists, engineers, operations folks responsible for, say, the actual agent staffing when it comes to human escalations from support channels, content design, like the conversation designers who actually write the content for the chatbot. So lots of different cross-functional teams come together to put these products together and give a class-leading member experience to Chime members.
Thanks for sharing that. And so now you also work on machine learning AI products. What is the collaboration like between you and data scientists or machine learning engineers?
Yeah. So in my current role, I'm responsible primarily for member satisfaction as well as cost reduction. So I'm more focused on those business outcomes. I do have a member services data science team where I am lucky enough to get some of the time of a few data scientists. So they're called data scientists by business title, but their skill set is closer to ML scientist. So they build models for my team's products, like the chatbot and IVR. I've mostly worked on contact intent prediction projects with them for the moment, but they're eager to work on other domains as well. So in essence, they're effectively my data science team, but they're not dedicated headcount on my end, for example, because they can spend some of their time on other member services projects. So that way, because I'm not sitting in the NIAL organization necessarily anymore, they're not directly my team, but I work very closely with them.
Yeah. So now you have transitioned into the PM side, mm-hmm. and you are focusing on a product roadmap, thinking about the users. Mm-hmm. And while working with data scientists, do you feel frustrated that you can't just get that feature done yourself? Do you miss the hands-on part of the work?
Honestly, I don't, because I've been lucky enough to work with excellent data scientists mm-hmm. and engineers where I can actually trust them to implement everything the way I would have done it myself or how I'd like to see it done.
Mm-hmm. And there's no job role that is perfect. So now you're in the PM role. What are some challenges you faced that you didn't know before?
Yeah. So I find that a lot of those challenges are specific to each given PM role. It's hard to say that, oh, in general, PM roles have these drawbacks, engineering roles have these drawbacks. Versus those generalities, I'd say specifically speaking, mm-hmm. in PM roles, you have to prioritize your time ruthlessly between all different things you could be working on. You can't say dive too deep into a given problem, even if it's interesting, or even if you think it's important, since if you focus too much on any one thing, you'll end up neglecting some other things that also need your attention. So you have to essentially be a jack of all trades or really spread yourself thin between different areas. So at times I missed opportunities to dive deeper into something and really focus on getting something done to the highest standard or to my preferred standard. But overall, I really enjoy PM work since I prefer to be a generalist.
Yeah.
I like putting my designer hat on when working with designers, mm-hmm. putting an ML hat on working with ML folks, engineering hat on working with engineers. You have business out on working with business. I really enjoy being spread thin.
Yeah, so. Especially you have been on their side before. So you understand not just the business metric, also machine learning metrics. You understand mm-hmm. it takes time for folks to understand their data, clean the data, mm-hmm. build the pipelines, mm-hmm. more empathy for the engineers, and you speak their lingo. So can you share more about a current project you worked on? For example, what are some problems you tried to solve and what exactly is your responsibility?
Yeah. So for instance, I've worked on multiple contact intent prediction projects across the chatbot and IVR spaces. Some of the challenges there are given, say, the data that we have at our disposal at Chime about prior contacts, prior agent escalations, how do we go through it to identify the highest leverage areas where we could predict, say, a contact reason with an ML model. So there are two aspects to that. One aspect is feature importance, where what aspects of member behavior or what pieces of member metadata that we have are most predictive of why they're reaching out. That's one aspect. Mm. The other aspect is among the specific contact intents we can predict reliably, which are the highest leverage, as in how can we have the biggest, which classes can we have the biggest business impact as in reduced escalation, increased satisfaction by predicting? So in kind of balancing what's possible with the data that we have versus what's the biggest impact we can have with the content or the products that we build on top of the content intent prediction ML stuff, mm-hmm. I think those trade-offs are the challenges that I've faced in this role that I've really enjoyed.
Mm. So you talk about to figure out what features are more important. So mm-hmm. Is it a lot around model interpretability?
Yeah, so that's relevant, especially from a compliance perspective, mm-hmm. in that, say, if we predict that for a given member, maybe they want to close their account, from a compliance perspective, what signals are we using to tell someone that maybe they want to close their account?
Yeah.
And how can we vet those such that it's not falling afoul of any bank partner guidelines?
Mm-hmm.
So actually, to kind of sidestep that issue, we decided not to predict that particular class because encouraging folks to close their account, even if we think that's what they want to do, mm-hmm. isn't necessarily the best idea from a business perspective. But that's just a look into the kind of trade-offs that you face when you're designing these ML models for these key business applications.
Yeah. This is so interesting because as a data scientist, sometimes I try to interpret a model, look at feature importance score, but there is a gap. I don't always know whether it's true in terms of users. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have to get past other teams, product managers, or maybe mm-hmm. even mm-hmm. different companies if you're working in a consulting role. So sometimes those questions left unanswered.
Mm-hmm.
So for you, What is the processes? So for example, data scientists tell you, okay, those are the features. This example, maybe their location, their age are most important for a specific action. How do you validate or test that assumption?
Yeah. So I compare what they tell me or their own feature reports analysis with empirical data I see from, say, the chatbot user perspective, as in, for example, we can actually associate survey responses with consequent chatbot sessions or even a member's chatbot session history, contact history. And so if I trace back a given member or even given member cohort's behavior across different channels, I can identify patterns as to how they use the chatbot or all the times they use the support products versus how often they respond to surveys to kind of fill in the gaps between the overall member journey, member experience versus the specific analysis that, say, the ML scientists put together when they're doing feature importance checks. So basically, I put their work in the context of the broader member experience by checking the data myself. And so I try to look at correlations more holistically between different channels.
Got it. So you still do some data analysis yourself?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. I delegate a lot of it to my excellent product analytics partners, but I do a little bit myself. I don't want to get too far away from it.
I see. So let's see if I understand it correctly. You have data scientists or machine learning engineers build models and tell you their assumptions about important features. And then you come out with a strategy to test their assumptions. And you also have product analytics partners who are focusing on probably pulling the data, doing a lot of SQL works and running correlation analysis more on the analytics side and to tell you whether their assumptions are correct or not.
Yep, exactly. And what I emphasize is that this is all a very collaborative process. So usually it's me, a data scientist and product analytics person, all in the same Zoom meeting, talking about how to compare, say, results of analysis that the data scientist did with, say, broader product analytics results from the analyst perspective. And so we're all brainstorming together. It's not like I'm the conduit between different functions. I just facilitate collaboration between everyone. So that way everyone is hands-on and involved in model development and scoping process.
Yeah. So that's very interesting because you are collaborating with two typical data science personas. So when we talk about data scientists, it's a very broad term. Some people focusing on machine learning model production and some people focusing on the analytics side. And I think it's a great way to have those separations in your organization because I don't want to say they're checking each other's work, but kind of function as a sounding board. You have the machine learning scientists, they already have their own domain knowledge. And sometimes if they check their own work, sometimes they might go into a dead end. But you have someone else on the analytics side from the product side with a fresh eye, and they can form new assumptions, have new ideas, and then they can take it back and maybe build a different model. Yeah. But another question I have is, I think it's great to have a different type of job roles to collaborate, but isn't that sometimes slow down the whole discovery process?
So you're saying that trying to collaboratively make decisions when you bring in, say, analytics stakeholders alongside ML modelers and product all in the same meeting, for example, you say that doesn't that slow down decisions? Is that what you're implying?
Yeah. So for example, I know a lot of teams that the data scientists wear every hat. I wouldn't say that's ideal, but sometimes they quickly have access to those analytics data. They can validate themselves. Like I mentioned, it's not as good as someone coming with a fresh eye, but they can get a feedback faster compared to having to collaborate with another team and also with a product manager. I mean, there's a pros and cons. So my question is more like open-ended question. What do you think about the pros and cons of have different data, let's just say data persona collaborate on the project versus have one person doing everything a little bit?
Yeah. So I'd say that it depends on the specific business domain as well as the timelines you have in mind for the shipping the model. Mm. Specifically, in my case, at Chime, it's a tightly regulated industry, as in consumer banking. And also, I'm in a domain which is quite sensitive, as in member support, where we need to be careful not to mislead members about, say, where their money is or give them the wrong idea about anything. So given those constraints where model correctness or precision are more highly valued than, say, quickly shipping or even being comprehensive in terms of prediction classes or coverage, given those trade-offs, I find that taking more time to carefully scope models or think through all the possible cases where it could be used, implications thereof, that sort of thing. The more time you spend doing that, actually, the more quickly you can launch and stay launched, not run into issues where, say, you have to throttle a class after launch or find that your models aren't giving you the results that you're hoping for in production. Mm-hmm. So I find that it's the cliche is measure twice, cut once. That's especially true in this domain where I'm in. It may not be true in other areas where, for example, if you're in a different B2C domain, for example, social media is another cliche where you can do experimentation much more quickly. The consequences of, say, a suboptimally performing model are much, much more slight. So you should really make more unilateral decisions, ship quickly, and experiment more to see what works best. There, yeah, more unilateral decision making would make sense. Here in my domain, I prefer to be more collaborative, take the time to make sure every stakeholder is on the same page.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's my next question. So now you play in a role where you have your stakeholders and you communicate with the data scientists, and they probably mm-hmm. have their own mm-hmm. managers focusing on research, model deployment. So sometimes your business product side of stakeholder might want things to go faster. They're like, oh, we can take more risk and it's okay, but we just want to have this launch. And then data scientists, like you mentioned, maybe want to spend more time to validate the model, have more confidence in the result.
That's not always true, though. Yeah. Many data scientists want to see the results of their models in production mm-hmm. and understand the real impact that the models are having on consumers. So there's a lot of variation even among ML scientists.
Yeah. So when there's a conflict about speed and quality from different side, how do you work with those two type of, say, your business stakeholder versus data science counterparts?
Yeah. In general, I've only faced that conflict between, say, my very senior leadership mm-hmm. versus what I and the broader team want to do. Usually, I manage to be on the same page with all the folks I directly work with, more on the direct product side.
Yeah.
And usually, it's pressure to, say, launch more quickly or even to take more time sometimes comes from the very senior leadership, like VP and above. Mm-hmm. So there, I think it boils down to empathy, where you talk to the relevant stakeholders, make sure that they know you understand their perspective and you're hearing them, and then you articulate your case or the case that that your stakeholders are making to you about why they need more time or why they want to ship faster. Give it to the leader, because at the end, they are the decision maker, and then go ahead with whatever that they decide. But in general, if you present your case effectively, you can get the leadership to agree with what you're planning from an execution perspective. Mm-hmm. In terms of goals or KPIs, leadership will have final say, and they may not always agree with you. But you have to kind of work around that. But in terms of execution, you can usually do what you want to do as long as you frame it in the appropriate way to leadership in a way that addresses their concerns.
Yeah. So do you have a specific example? For example, if I'm the leadership, how mm-hmm. do you frame your suggestions to me in this type of conflict? For example, I want things fast, and how do you convince me that I need to be more patient?
Yeah. So the typical framework I use is an appeal to longer term thinking or basically make the point that, yeah, we can certainly deliver on your request and ship this model, ship this integration more quickly. However, if we cut the corners by not doing this additional testing or offline validation prior to shipping, then you'll find that we have to make changes post-launch. We have to do a partial rollback. There may be, say, member impact in terms of inconsistent experience or momentary declines in member satisfaction. So if you're willing to accept all these negative trade-offs, we can go ahead with your plan and ship faster. But in terms of overall long-term value, I find that taking the more careful approach to ship a bit slower in this example would be the better decision for members overall, but I defer to you to make the decision. Usually, if you frame it that way, bring concrete examples and validation from other stakeholders. From an execution perspective, leaders are not that opinionated. They will accept it. And then if something goes wrong, they know who to blame at least. Leaders can be more opinionated typically when it comes to top line KPIs or visibility to their own leaders in turn. That's where you can't always get your way. That's where things can get more difficult.
Yeah.
But again, it all depends on the situation.
Yeah, I like that. So you basically lay out the potential consequences if you adopt their timeline, and then basically it leaves to them to decide, okay, do you want to take that risk or do I want to listen to the experts?
Exactly. It's no different from basic rhetoric or argumentation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. And when I work as a data scientist, so sometimes I come up with new ideas. So I kind of wear the PM hat when I want to build a use case for my customer. So I'm curious now as a product manager, do you come up with new ideas? Do you take suggestions from the data scientists? How does the process work?
Yeah, I'd say it's a combination of both in that the people I work with, many of them have prior experience in the chatbot space or even in the financial domain. So a lot of them have specific ideas about what's worked for them before or what doesn't work well. So they listen to that feedback and incorporate it into the roadmap. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, of course, I have my own ideas as well. In the end, as the PM, I do control the roadmap myself, but I make sure to take input from other perspectives where they have information I don't have myself and make sure they're reflected in my roadmap.
Yeah. And when I collaborate with data scientists, including myself, so sometimes I want to try a new model, I'm not focusing so much on the business impact. Sometimes I just want to use a new technique I learned. For example, in terms of chatbot, maybe with the launch of GPT-3, some data scientists say, hey, can we try that? Of course, they want it to be useful, but they're focusing on the novelty of a method. So, and from your product perspective, maybe that's not a priority in terms of product. And then if you say no, the data scientist might feel frustrated. So how do you handle those suggestions where data scientists want to try new models?
So frankly, I try to be as hands-off as possible in terms of execution in that I'm working with good people. I can trust their decisions on which tools to use, what makes the most sense, what they have time to build. In the end, they understand that they're responsible for overall model performance, which includes deployment complexity or time to deploy. So if they want to experiment with say, more advanced architectures or state-of-the-art research, and they can't meet their own guidelines for, say, appropriate deployment time, then it's on them, right? So in the end, I make the incentives or make the business needs very clear. They can deliver on it however they wish. They can use their own time to experiment. I encourage experimentation and innovation. I want to give them as much time as possible to do that. But in the end, the objectives are very clear. If they don't meet them, it's on them.
So. Yeah. That makes sense. And also for data scientists, our job sometimes is very hard to estimate how long it takes us to finish a project because it's both engineering and research, and sometimes those research ideas fail, which is normal. So
of course,
sometimes when I go into a planning meeting, a PM might ask me, oh, how long do you think you deliver this? I honestly don't know.
Yeah.
I probably can only find out when I start a little bit, but a product manager needs to have those timeline in their docs. So how do you help data scientists estimate how much time and resources they need?
Yeah. So in essence, I work with them to break down projects into different phases, like say initial data collection or model scoping. That's more open-ended, so I don't attach timelines to that. Another thing about timelines, when we have say more defined model scope, like a specific ML problem, output classes, that sort of thing. Only after that, typically your senior scientists and above can then estimate, okay, given all this, I could deliver a model in roughly this amount of time, including different approach exploration, that sort of thing. So I only estimate when needed and start to give timelines when absolutely necessary. I try to avoid as much as possible doing so during the initial experimentation or exploration phase. And the reasoning for this is if you want the best possible model, best possible products, you need to have the open-ended time for creativity, actively push back on giving deadlines. If you're ever pressed to give rough timeframes, even if the time frames are never used, I give very vague timeframes, generous timeframes to allow for that research because you need that if you want good models.
Yeah, I'm sure data scientists on your team really appreciate that. Flexibility.
You can't do good model development work without that kind of flexibility, period.
Yeah. So when I started my career, I didn't know those timelines are all decided by human, and those things can be moved if it doesn't work.
They can often be quite arbitrary.
Yeah,
where,
exactly.
For example, program management may have some processes or requirements to put deadlines or put estimated project plans. But the secret is outside of the actual launch dates or goals for, say, a given quarter or half, the deadlines don't really mean anything. The project plans don't really mean that much. As long as you meet the goals for the given quarter or half from a KPI perspective, execution details and timing don't usually matter that much.
Yeah.
The trick is finding out what plans or what timelines are inflexible, what you have to comply with versus what's more flexible, and then coordinating accordingly.
Yeah.
So another strategy is often with my project, for example, ML model is just one part of it. It's part of a broader product or feature offering where there's a UX design component, there's an engineering component where there's back-end integration stuff and front-end. When you have all these moving parts, plus, of course, in my industry, banking or compliance approval, then you can easily stagger the development cycle around those different XFN dependencies such that if, say, a compliance delay can give your scientists a couple more weeks to do some more experimentation, try some new approaches. Mm-hmm. So if you stagger out different timelines, give yourself those cross-functional buffers, you can give your science team more flexibility and still meet business goals.
Yeah. So if you work with a product manager or any other counterparts, if you feel like the timeline doesn't make sense, communicate and you can push back. And I think you don't need to just say, no, I need more time. Provide some details to justify, for example, you need time to access some database or do more exploratory analysis. And just like you mentioned before, you don't want to deal with the aftermath of doing analysis, too quickly. So those things can be discussed, can be negotiated, and then have a close relationship with your business partner.
All this is true as long as When you give time estimate, when you make a promise, you over-deliver on it or you remain conservative with timelines you give cross-functional partners. Mm-hmm. If you do everything Daliana said, but the timelines you give when you do give a timeline aren't accurate or you slip often, you'll lose the trust of people around you and then you won't have that level of agency anymore. So if you want the additional time to experiment, if you don't want people breathing down your neck chasing you, you have to earn their trust.
Yeah. And can you share one of the most high impact project you have worked on in time?
Yeah. So I'd say that going back to the contact intent prediction projects, just by doing a better job of when a member opens up the chatbot from the Chime mobile app or by calling into the Chime IVR or the support phone line, just by adding these more relevant predictions as to why they're calling in, we're able to reduce escalation rate by on the order of a percentage for each channel, which may not sound like a lot, but it does result in, for the total across bot and IVR, multiple millions of dollars of annualized cost savings in terms of saved agent escalation costs or even transfers between different types of agents. So the key is if you're in a high leverage space, you can do a lot to save cost just by being smarter about how you direct inbound calls, that sort of thing.
Mm. And what is the machine learning components in it?
Yeah. And then the ML aspect is actually predicting based on, say, the features that we have for a given member about, say, their activity with Chime, what they've done recently, have they opened a dispute lately, how long have they been members, based on composite of all the different features that models have access to, we can predict with fairly high confidence one of, say, on the order of 20 classes, for example, in the latest 20 to 25 class in the latest model, as to what they are calling about. And so just having the prediction right can take them to better quality self-service options, thus obviating the need to escalate directly to an agent. That's one ideal case. The other case is, even if they have to go to an agent, if we can take them to the right specialized type of agent based on what we think they want to talk to an agent about, we can avoid agent-to-agent transfers, which can cost a lot of money because multiple agents' time. Mm-hmm. And that way they can get just to the right human being first. So lots of different ways where you can save money by just better predictions. So in that way, using the support domain, saving money doesn't just come from preventing human escalation or making the support experience worse. You can have quite a bit of leverage to improve experience while reducing cost.
And what is the primary metric for this? Is it how much money you saved, or do you look at precision recall? Do you have any safety metric? For example, the precision, say, has to be at a certain level.
Yeah. So I look at precision recall out of personal interest, given my background, and also to get a sense of model performance. Mm-hmm. But from a business perspective, I'm only concerned with the member satisfaction scores that we get, as well as the cost reductions, as in reduced escalation rate, that we can show. Mm-hmm. So I'm only concerned with those top line business metrics. However, personally, I'm curious about the model metrics, and say if we do see that, say, precision recall fall below certain thresholds, then we have to throttle some classes where we're not performing well and make sure that those leading indicators don't tank, say, the business metrics that we care about at the end of the day.
Right.
So everything matters, but I only am supposed to care about the business metrics.
Mm-hmm. And those business metrics might not be a direct function of the machine learning model, but they're associated. So how did you help the data scientists translate satisfaction rate and the money they saved into their machine learning models metrics?
Yeah. So one big challenge is that oftentimes, especially in this contact intent prediction space, our models perform quite well in predicting the reason why a member is opening the bot or calling in. However, the self-service or our automated resolution content we can offer a member isn't always as useful to the member as an agent could be in the same scenario. Mm. Because of, say, technical limitations within Chime, or just bandwidth limitations in terms of having enough people write new novel content. So in those cases, we can differentiate between getting the right prediction, but that member not being happy with how we serve the prediction, versus getting the wrong prediction and member being unhappy because of us giving the wrong prediction. Mm-hmm. So that's where we can see compare difference between, say, engagement with predictions, as in how often do members interact with the prediction on either the bot or the IVR, versus how often do they escalate from a prediction. The implication being that engagement with the prediction implies the prediction is right, but doesn't say anything about the content. Choosing to escalate from a prediction menu, as opposed to going forward with self-service from prediction menu, implies that prediction was right, but the content was not quite right. So with those correlations, we can kind of identify where the model went right, content went wrong, or model went wrong, content went right, or maybe both went wrong. So that's how we can dive deeper into the data to understand better what's going on.
Got it. And so in this process, while you're doing a deep dive on the model, is the model completely launched in production or is partially launched? How do you continuously improve the model?
So it's always launched initially as some type of A-B test in the interest of continuous experimentation.
Yeah.
So typically, it's often 50-50, where half the population gets the treatment or the new model, other half gets the previous version of the model or simply static when we're introducing a model into a new domain. And so based on that, we can clearly identify differences between treatment control groups once we have enough volume to be statistically significant, of course. And so in between different changes, we can turn the experiment off and then run different experiments based on different model versions. And that way, we can clearly isolate differences between different model versions or even different product presentations of the same model content.
Mm-hmm. And are you also working with data scientists or engineers when it comes to model productionization?
Yeah. So in essence, the data scientists at Chime responsible for model development, they're like ML scientists. They're a separate machine learning platform team where ML engineers help those data scientists to actually deploy those models into production. And then my engineering team works with those ML engineers to call those real-time inference endpoints and do the real-time integrations where we think about latency and that sort of thing.
Yeah. And previously, you were a deep learning architect, so you're very familiar with the process, tools, practices when putting model in production. So now when you work with other ML engineers, say, for example, they do it in one way and you think maybe there's another way that's better. Do you make the suggestion or you leave it for them to make the decision? You try to stay in your own lane.
Yeah. So if I clearly see areas where I know something that could be helpful,
yeah,
I'm happy to speak up about it and share my perspective. Mm-hmm. But in the end, this is not my race, right?
Yeah.
It's their responsibility to do what makes sense for them in the context of the tooling at Chime or what their priorities are, what they're able to build based on the resourcing. So I, of course, defer the ultimate choice to them. It's their job. But I'm happy to provide suggestions as long as they're helpful or they're welcomed.
Yeah. And you mentioned before the business metrics you care about are customer satisfaction, amount of money is saved. So I'm curious, what is the metrics for success of a PM? Is it how many new features you launch, or it's only around the business metric you mentioned? For example, if I have met a goals around mm-hmm. customer satisfaction, or I have saved, say, $10 million, then I'm done. Like, this feature is just met my this year's goal. I don't need to do anything else. How does this work?
Yeah. This is a great philosophical question, because whenever anything becomes a goal, you can easily game anything just to give the optimal KPI result,
right,
while not necessarily addressing the core business need that KPI is supposed mm-hmm. to map to. I think there's some name for this, some something law. I forget what it's called, but it's quite a common phenomenon.
Yeah.
So I would argue that a high-performing PM organization considers KPIs when evaluating PM success. They matter quite a bit, but at the same time, you should evaluate how those KPIs are reached, how, say, cross-functional partners meet their own KPIs in relation to top-line business KPIs. And that's the way we can kind of holistically evaluate the performance of a given PM or PM organization. Mm. So it's a very hard question. I'm not a people manager, so I don't necessarily know the best answer, but I do know a lot of the pitfalls in how you measure success. So I have some understanding of the different aspects to think about when you think about measuring success.
Yeah. And also, there are a lot of metrics. You can always cherry pick metrics to say, hey, I made a certain amount of impact. So sometimes it's hard to be completely honest with a project. So how do you make sure you are honest with yourself? You're keeping yourself accountable when it comes to launching a new feature.
Yeah. So I work closely with cross-functional stakeholders like the data scientists or product analytics partners to make sure that I can estimate the impact of the new features I'm building, both in terms of business KPIs, as well as, say, domain-specific metrics, like even model metrics, that sort of thing, because, of course, the modeling teams need that for their own performance evaluation, right? So I work with them to make sure that I have sound, conservative estimates, and I bring that to my leadership and make sure that they sign off on that as well, adjust as needed based on what they demand, and move forward from there. In essence, I use consensus and inputs from people with different perspectives to keep myself honest in terms of reporting up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. Now, going back to our times in Amazon, mm-hmm. I'd like to talk more about some cool projects or high impact project you worked on. Mm-hmm. Would you like to share one?
Yeah. So we've worked on quite a number of different customer projects in our time together at the ML Solutions Lab. Mm-hmm. I can't think of that many in a lot of detail that I want to go through piece by piece, but maybe we can talk more generally about our engagement lifecycle or common challenges or things we enjoyed there. Maybe that one would work as well.
What are something challenging while you were there?
Mm-hmm. So yeah. There, I think a common challenge in that team is, I alluded to this earlier, where given that you're coming in as effectively pre-sales consultants tasked with building a proof of concept that in theory would demonstrate business value to your end customer if put into production, you have an incentive to do work that in theory seems on paper that it would be high leverage or it looks good on a presentation, but you don't necessarily have to think as much about how your work is ultimately deployed to production, mm-hmm. even though the end goal is to ideally drive that workload to production, maybe hand it off to a post-sale production team to implement on an hourly consultant, like paid consultant basis.
Yeah.
So I think that tension often leads projects in the MLS capacity to not be as complex in from an ML perspective or not have as much experimentation using state-of-the-art models. Instead, focus on quick and dirty or simple solutions that will work well, especially in customer use cases where we're dealing with a lot of big Fortune 50 legacy type customers that may not have advanced data practices or have a really mature understanding of how to clean data up. So your focus is really on meeting all the relevant stakeholders at those companies, getting data as cleanly as you can get it, or teaching them how important it is to get clean data, and then using simple models like trees and so forth to get a quick business win that looks good on a slide that you could in theory take to production, but then you leave before you get a chance to see it through to production. So I think those are some of the biggest challenges you see there.
Yeah. And so for you, what are some effort you try to put more models in production and make sure it's successful?
Yeah. So from my perspective as a deep learning architect, I help customers a lot with initial project scoping, as well as reasoning about how best to design models such that they can be deployed to production in the future, as well as providing high-level architectural guidance as to how they can put models into production. So given that, I was often tasked with working with, say, even customers' data science teams to nudge them toward ways of working that were more sustainable. Since, for example, many data scientists, they work in local notebooks on their own machines, or they use HPC clusters. They do things the way that they're used to doing in the past, but I teach them that, okay, with, say, cloud services or with modern development tools, you can do the same work you're used to doing in a more efficient way that not only speeds up your own process of iteration or trying different model variations, but also makes it easier to, when it comes to deployment time, ship models to production. So I think just teaching best practices, showing how the way of working you're used to can be modernized to an extent while still respecting their own preferences and not messing up the workflow entirely. Those are the problems that I've focused on in my time there.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because when we think about translating your model output into business impact, you need to think about modeling production in the beginning, in the scoping, like you mentioned, instead of separating those processes. Oh, I just think about focusing on the model, building a quick solution, and maybe in the end, it won't fit in the customer's production environments. So you want to know what tools are they using. Are they very mature? Are they open to exploring something new? And also, how many people are going to work on that? What's their skill set? Are they data scientists, data analysts, data engineer, or machine learning engineers? So those are all the information you need to gather in the beginning of the project.
Exactly. So in my role as an ML deep learning architect or ML solutions architect, I was like a teacher in that I have knowledge of all these different tools or ways of working. I can teach them to the customers I work with, understand their needs deeply so that I can give them these new tools in a way that doesn't disrupt or totally overwrite how they're used to working, but helps them to be more efficient. And that's the best way to teach. Not say everything you're doing is wrong, but instead say, okay, I totally understand the way you're working. Here's a way that you can consider to make it even better.
Yeah, that's a great point. And also, I think although a lot of companies have adopted machine learning solutions, but still part of the data scientist or machine learning engineer's job is to educate. Sometimes you need to tell people machine learning isn't magic. There's always caveats in the model.
Yeah, educating business stakeholders. Yeah. That's also very important.
Yeah.
Especially in a lot of so-called legacy companies or large companies that are new to ML. ML is a horribly abused and poorly misunderstood buzzword.
Yeah.
So given that, folks can have sometimes unrealistic expectations as to how it can be used or potential pitfalls of ML. So your job is to kind of demystify it, take away all the glitz, glamour, make it not a buzzword anymore, explain it in the simplest terms, show them how they can use it to deliver everyday business value. And so that way they truly incorporate it into their workflow as something to help them do their work, as opposed to a cool buzzword to put on a PowerPoint slide.
Yeah. And what was your favorite part about working in Machine Learning Solutions Lab?
I'd say that the diversity of customers and use cases, while I did complain about, say, the lack of technical depth or lack of the ability to do super state-of-the-art work at times, that was made up for in part by getting a chance to do work in so many different industries, different use cases, face different types of challenges, both from business perspective in terms of explaining ML or really selling ML to stakeholders who had different levels of familiarity with ML, as well as facing different types of data infrastructures, different levels of data sophistication at different companies. So just how diverse the job was, how much it varied day to day. I enjoyed that quite a bit.
Yeah. And also in Amazon in general, there's something called PR FAQ. So that means when you have a new idea of a business, a product, you can write a document to talk about your vision of how this product is going to be launched, how many people or business it will impact. So while we were at Machine Learning Solutions Lab, we were encouraged to have this think big exercise. We'll do this in team meetings. So we get a lot of inspirations while working with different type of business from all the industries, from sports to like healthcare. And I think that's a very interesting thing. Do you remember you wrote any PRFAQ or contribute to Think Big ideas?
Yep. I wrote a couple and also edited some others as well. I was able to have a organization-wide knowledge sharing system implemented across the ML Solutions Lab. And as a result of a PRFAQ, I co-wrote with a teammate. And beyond that, I actually edited some other PRFQs that teammate wrote to promote investing in building reusable solutions for, say, ML model development or training data across different industry vertical use cases. Since, to Daliana's point, in our team, we saw a lot of repeating problems across different companies in the same industry, or even different but close related industries. And so if we could build these reusable offerings, even turn them into marketable services, that could become a source of recurring revenue totally separate from customer engagements or closing these multi-year enterprise discount plans, that sort of thing. So a new way for organizations to generate revenue with external customers. And those PRFAQs got adopted and turned into new products, actually.
Yeah. And what are some other processes or programs you helped launch there?
Yeah. So I was also lucky enough to have a PRFAQ approved to effectively build out a new industry vertical team focused on supporting startup business development team, where we would identify startups that could benefit from ML proofs of concept, or even just ML consultation, like hands-off an hour of week type of work from the ML Research Lab team. I don't know what became of it after I left the team, but while I was there, I was able to get that pipeline started and help a few startups out. So,
And I really like the part you mentioned, reusable assets. I think even if you don't work in consulting, as a data scientist, a lot of our works, you always do the same type of work. For example, data visualization, it's always helpful to think about, okay, what are some reusable asset, or including code, it could be PowerPoint slides that can help you deliver project faster. And also you don't always have to start from ground zero. I think to maybe think about your entire workflow from a product manager's perspective. Maybe you can have your personal modules saved, and you can always leverage those pieces of code. So basically, it's kind of like, I wouldn't say it's like auto ML, but you have your own infrastructure built. So maybe you have solved a lot of churn prediction problem or a fraud detection. And whenever those use cases come your way, you can use your previous assets to quickly test a baseline before you dive deeper to customize your previous solution to the new problem.
Yeah, the way I'd frame it is never solve the same problem twice. So the key challenge is identifying reusable code snippets or general model architectures that would work across use cases in different industries or different sets of data without, say, polluting data, like taking one customer data and using another. Those are big no-nos, of course. how do you reuse as much of your work as possible? Because in the end, Amazon or whatever company you work for owns the IP, not your customer. So how do you make the best use of the IP, reuse it across different use cases while keeping data from different customers, different use cases tightly siloed, and making sure your models are do the best they can be for each given use case? And so the first step of that is, to Daliana's point, reuse just for your personal workflow efficiency improvement. The next step is, if you have reusable artifacts that are mature enough, you can actually package those into nice products and services, start selling them directly to external customers. And so that can be a big source of incremental revenue. So that's another interesting area to explore.
Yeah. So while you were at Machine Learning Solutions Lab, you wanted to transition to a product manager. So I think while you were still in the deep learning architect job title, you split your time between data science project and product management. So you kind of transitioned in this job, and then you joined Chime, and you're doing product management. 100%. So I know a lot of people in analytics or data science are considering transition to a product manager, and some people also thinking about doing an associate PM program. So what's your advice for people who want to transition into product management?
Yeah. So I'd say that associate PM or APM programs are mostly intended for new undergraduate college graduates where they have not gotten professional experience yet. They want to start their career as PMs. So they're effectively put into these two-year training programs where they learn how to be a PM. They do rotations across different product areas to learn those basic skills. And then they graduate as junior PMs. And at that point, they're hopefully self-sufficient. So that's probably the most direct route to become a product manager. However, the challenge is, you don't develop any domain expertise. It's hard to market yourself as, say, a specialist or an expert in a given area. The only advantage is it's maybe easier to get a PM job because you've always had the title. So I think in the near term, it may be the most direct way to become a PM. You don't have to struggle to change career paths later on, but later on, it may make it more difficult for you to identify a key niche or really develop your skills in a specific area to add a lot of value so you can ask for higher compensation or you can do more specialized or advanced work. So I think those are the trade-offs with APM programs specifically. And I'd say that while you can do an APM program, while you're already in the industry, you're transitioning to a different role, I'd say that would represent a career step back for a lot of people. I would advise folks who are already in an adjacent field like, say, data science, analytics, even software engineering, ML model development. If you're in an adjacent field and you want to try product management, the first step is, of course, in your current role, try to do more product management type work, like, say, building a business case for the work you're already doing, doing some more cross-team collaboration work to, say, get buy-in from others and slowly develop a name for yourself as, say, someone with good product sense. And then this varies so much based on your team and where you are at in your organization. Sometimes you can get really lucky and get support to transition to PM directly where you are. This is the most straightforward approach. If you're not as lucky in terms of those situations, you can basically market yourself on your resume with the product work you've already done, how you've operated as a PM. Try to get the title on your resume by doing more formal rotations as a PM in your current role. Then with the title on your resume, with the relevant experience that you can talk about in behavioral interviews, then you can try and find PM roles elsewhere where you can move laterally, not take a step back in your career, and also leverage domain expertise you have in your prior area of work. So I'd recommend that route. So even though it's not as straightforward as, say, APM, you don't take any step back in your career, and you start with a specialization or a key area you can use to make yourself more marketable or turn yourself into some type of specialist or expert.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a great point to leverage your current role. And there are also some PM want to transition into data science. Sometimes it's challenging for them to get a permission to have access to the data to do some analysis. But if you want to transition into PM as a data scientist, I think you have the advantage because every project is basically a product. Whether you are building a dashboard or a machine learning model or even an ad hoc analysis, you can think of it as a product. So if you can think from the user's perspective, collaborate with other stakeholders, especially write down your vision. I think the documentation is very important. So leverage your current experiences. I would say there's a lot of opportunities that can help you build up your PM resume while you're in a data science or machine learning role.
Yeah. Although one caveat is, like I mentioned earlier, there's often an inverse correlation between how rigorous or technical or green field your work is. For example, if you're, and negative correlation between that and how close you are to the business outcome or how directly you can transition to a product management role. For example, if you're focused on publishing papers, doing state-of-the-art research in a core ML research team, you may, of course, find it more difficult to do product management in that space. However, because you have that very deep domain expertise, that focused skill set, you can potentially find other roles that expect that type of deep understanding from a PM, because in those business areas, you can only have the highest leverage product or business impact if you understand the domain deeply. For example, personalization recommendation use cases where incremental improvements in personalization recommendation, which can only be done with state-of-the-art techniques, result in material business improvements like meaningful incremental revenue gains. So you can leverage your prior research work to go into that more specialized field, but it's very hard to go directly the more complex or more nuanced your work is.
Yeah. And also sometimes when it comes to a new role, you don't really know whether it's a good fit for you. So while you are taking more PM responsibility as a data scientist, it's kind of a way for you to experiment to find out whether you enjoy that type of work. And maybe after you wear some PM hat, you realize, oh, I don't really enjoy that. You can always revert back to your data scientist role. So it's not like you want to switch to a role and it's a one-way door. And in Amazon, we talk about two-way door, right? You make a decision, and if it doesn't work, you can revert back. So make sure you give yourself that type of space to experiment while you still hold the data scientist job title.
Although one challenge is the more time you devote to responsibilities outside your core job title, especially when it comes to, say, if you're in a technical role, the more time and effort you spend doing less technical work, the harder you have to work to catch up to, say, peers in your same area from a technical perspective.
Yeah.
So in that sense, there are always unavoidable trade-offs. Daliana's advice is quite good in that as long as you're still in that technical role, it's not a one-way door. You can go back if you find that the product work is not the best fit for you. But there's always a trade-off inherent to any decision you make. So it's important to keep those things in mind.
Yeah.
Nothing is free, unfortunately.
Right. And maybe give yourself a timeline. I'm going to experiment this for 3 months or 6 months. So it's not like forever. Force yourself to make a decision. So what was your plan at that time? Did you know 100% that you want to make this transition?
So like I said, even since when I was in university and graduating, I knew I eventually wanted to be a PM. So everything I did in my career after I joined Amazon as an engineer was with the goal of becoming a PM eventually, since I knew I could have the highest leverage there. So my thinking was, I care about understanding things down to the bottom. I care about being in an intellectually interesting and technically complex domain, but I always want to focus on the core business values. So I specifically sought out roles where I could balance those deep technical skills with always moving closer to the business side of things. So that way I could eventually become the PM I am today, where I have a proven track record of delivering positive business outcomes, but I never lose touch with the technology, understanding things to the ground level, because if I didn't have that, I wouldn't have credibility to myself. So that's my niche. That way I can credibly say that I am an applied ML PM. I can understand what scientists are talking about, even though I know that they are much more qualified than I am.
Yeah. So it's very impressive that you had this long-term planning while you're in university, and then you went down the hard way.
That's why I say that APM, being a PM right out of college, is way easier or way more direct with becoming a PM. Sometimes I feel like, oh, how could my career have gone if I had done that? But then I am grateful that I was able to transition this way, since because I worked in those technical roles and was able to succeed there, I have that additional technical depth. I have the extra credibility. So I think I am better off in my career as a PM. I can be more technical, more specialized for that depth of experience. But it certainly made it harder for me to transition to being a PM. I had to work very hard to maintain my long-term vision, because if you're in these technical roles, like I'm alluding to, your goals or your ideas for success in the role that you're in are often orthogonal to your own career vision or your long-term goals if you want to be a PM. So how do you balance succeeding in your current role, growing there, doing what is needed for the business or even for your management chain versus what you wanted for yourself? I think that balance is very challenging. That's what makes it very difficult to switch to PM the more technical you are. That's why I kind of keep going back to the trade-off aspect and how mindful you have to be about that decision.
Mm. And you're a very pragmatic thinker. So can you help us lay out the pros and cons for being a machine learning engineer and a PM? So for someone who can decide from your perspective, what do we enjoy the most as a machine learning engineer? And things you don't enjoy, and the same thing for being a PM.
I'd say it all depends on what do you personally find interesting? What do you personally want to do? The advantages of engineering are, of course, the compensation is higher, the market demand is higher in terms of, say, practical considerations, and say you have more career options, there are more job openings, even at very senior levels, but your focus is squarely on how best to do things, how to solve technical problems in the best possible way. Your focus is less on, say, the business impact or how best to increase revenue or do the right business thing with this technical knowledge. Whereas as a PM, you're less concerned with how best to do things or these technical details. You're more concerned with how can I have the best possible business impact, or how can I work with all these different stakeholders, these different cooks in the kitchen, so to speak, to make sure everyone has their needs met while I'm doing the right thing for the broader company or the business. And of course, making my manager look good, making management chain happy. So I think it depends on your personal interest and where you find that your personal talents or skill set happens to be. For example, I always consider myself to be a humanities person. I am not a tech person or a STEM person. I don't see myself that way. Mm-hmm. But I really care about understanding things deeply, like I've mentioned before. So I studied a technical subject. I cared about understanding it to the bottom. But once I had that baseline training and I refined that with my technical work in industry, I wanted to focus on my natural talents, doing that more humanistic or doing that more business-oriented work to leverage where I saw my natural talent to be.
Mm-hmm. And now you finally got to the PM role. Can you share something, some challenges specifically that you didn't know before? Like, what are some ugly truths about being a product manager?
Yeah, I'd say that a lot of times in product management, I talk a lot, especially I've spoken here today, about wanting to understand things down to the root level, really having the credibility. Oftentimes in product management, that doesn't matter that much, especially if you're very good at selling yourself or doing PR for your own projects. You can achieve quite a level of success, at least in the short term, even if you don't understand to the root level of what's going on. However, if you stay at somewhere long enough or you work on a broad enough area or complex enough area, not having that root level understanding will bite eventually. So I will say that if you really care about that level of depth, PMing can be disappointing in that sense, but still, since I have very broad and diverse interests, I enjoy PMing a lot more than I did being an engineer, even though sometimes I miss kind of the strive, the how you can strive for correctness in a more pure sense if you're in a purely technical role.
Yeah. Now you are a PM, your tool stack has changed a lot. So can you share what are the tools, what's your tech stack when you're a machine learning engineer versus now as a PM, what are some technical tools and productivity tools you use?
Yeah, so my tech stack is Chrome, Google Docs. So PowerPoint. I'm really using a lot of technical tools to do my daily job, clearly.
Yeah.
No, but more seriously, I do try to, of course, stay in touch with technical work in terms of going through notebooks that my product analytics partner goes through, reading the SQL, as well as on the ML side, actually reading model code and Python, as well as on the engineering side, reading the Ruby microservice code folks put together. Do I need to review all these things? Not at all. Again, I personally prefer to read them, so I know what's going on for sure. And sometimes when other teams sometimes had lack of clarity on scope and whatnot, reading the code has helped me to more quickly identify areas where, okay, oh, the scope of this is wrong. This has to be fixed before it goes to production. So there are fringe benefits to reading code, but you don't necessarily need to do it as a PM. Don't be discouraged if you're not technical. You don't need technical skills to be a good PM unless you're in an area where you have to understand key details to be more productive, which is not true of most areas. So yeah, I still do use technical tools, but I don't have to use them.
Yeah. And what kind of technical tools you used before?
Yeah. And then prior in my roles as an engineer and ML architect, engineering, of course, at Amazon, I was doing a lot of Java microservice development. So I was using IntelliJ, as well as a lot of internal Amazon build tools, like pipelines and so forth, all in Amazon CTO, which Alexa was part of for any of you who know that all the Amazon internal jargon. And then I moved to AWS. Of course, I got familiar with AWS services,
yeah,
like DynamoDB, SageMaker, of course, EC2. And so depending on the appropriate customer use case, I learned about new features and then taught customers how to use them. For example, a lot of my work centered on learning new SageMaker capabilities, whether it's in notebooks, as in individual deployment or experimentation environments, or even endpoints or areas where you can serve models in production. Mm-hmm. So I learned about new features, taught them to data scientists at different customer companies, and helped them to use them in production. So a lot of different tools.
Yeah. So previously you shared some high-impact projects you worked on, and can you share some mistakes you have made in your career?
Yeah. So I'd say that given that my original goal was to become a PM, I always wanted to become a PM, sometimes I do think that, oh, maybe starting as an engineer was a mistake because it took me time to transition to PM. Yeah. Sometimes it feels like a mistake, but other times I realize that, oh, because I started as an engineer, because I have the extra technical depth, I can be more credible, I can understand things better, and I can credibly be a specialized PM, I can ask for more compensation, yeah, I can be more senior. Sometimes I think of my choice as a mistake, sometimes I think of it as something I made the most of, but yeah, that's when it comes to trade-offs. It's hard to say it was a mistake all around, but definitely I can see a more direct path to PM that I could have taken instead of what I did.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for sharing that. And what are some things that you wish you have done more earlier in your career?
That's a good question. I think I've always been very deliberate about where to take my career in terms of having a clear long-term vision in mind. I would say one thing I could have probably done better is committing to transitioning more quickly to a PM role, or to kind of make that trade-off I allude to more quickly, as in deprioritize some of the deep technical understanding that I cared about in favor of moving more quickly toward the product side. I could have maybe done that better to become a PM more directly, but then given the situations I was in, I don't know how practical that would have been. So I don't want to say I didn't make a mistake, because I always think about how I could have done things better, you know, but I do think I made the best of the sort of situations I was in and the circumstances that I faced. I think I faced a lot of situations where the incentives of my team or of my company management chain at the time didn't align necessarily with my career goals or my personal growth. And so I made the best of balancing what I wanted to do with what was right for the business or what was right for the organization at the time. So I think I've made the most of a lot of not necessarily optimal situations, but in spite of that, I've learned so much. I've worked with wonderful people. I've learned, I've had great teammates. So no regrets.
Yeah. And talking about great teammates, do you have a favorite coworker?
Oh, I can't play favorites. But like I said, I've been privileged to work with so many great people in technical domains as well as non-technical domains, mm-hmm, across all these different job functions. I've been very lucky in that regard.
Okay. Maybe let me phrase it in a different way. Do you have a coworker or manager or mentor you learn the most from or have influenced you a lot?
I've always thought of my dad as my primary professional mentor, simply since even growing up as a small kid, I learned how to be diplomatic, how to be professional from him. Mm. So even in college, even when I started working, I already had a lot of those basic skills. They're just ingrained in me from observing him.
Yeah.
When other people were just learning them. So I think I was able to progress much more quickly in my career because of the head start I got from just learning from him by observation. But my dad is almost the opposite of me in terms of not setting boundaries, saying no to doing extra stuff when just he's at his limit. So yeah. I lecture him. I help him all the time to set better boundaries mm-hmm. and not give too much of himself away or spread himself too thin. So I think I've been able to teach him a little bit, but it's nothing in comparison to everything that I've learned from him growing up.
Yeah, that's awesome. Actually, I was going to ask you, how did you develop your communication skills? So I think that all makes sense now. You learn from your dad. What does your dad do in his profession?
Yeah, so my dad spent the bulk of his career doing technology in the financial services industry. He worked for private banks, investment banks, mm-hmm. and currently he did move over to technology where he's currently a senior engineering manager at a big company. So mm-hmm. basically he's been in technology his whole career. He has a lot of financial domain expertise, but he's now moved to pure technology.
Mm, cool. What is a very important piece of feedback you got throughout your career? Could be from your colleagues, could be from your dad.
Yeah, I would say speak more slowly. That's something I'm still working on. And as you can see, I still have quite a long way to go, uh-huh. but I'll get there.
I think it's fine, especially in the podcast. I think it's very engaging when you talk faster, so folks don't need to 2x but the episode.
I'll be frank. I don't listen to many podcasts mm-hmm. since typically I find the speed at which you can get information via hearing is way slower than how I can read. So mm-hmm. unless I read a podcast transcript because I read it at my own pace or
yeah.
I listen to a podcast at 3x or so and I'm listening closely so I don't miss words, it's kind of boring to me. So
yeah, well, yeah. You can send it to
I do more reading than I do listening.
Yeah, yeah. You can send the episode to your dad. I'm sure he's allowed to listen to it. So okay, when we talked about reading, what type of books or materials, papers do you like to read about?
Yeah, so when it comes to, say, professional stuff, I enjoy reading state-of-the-art research in machine learning just to keep track of where the industry is going, what are the trends, that sort of thing, stay credible, so to speak. And beyond that, I do like reading, say, PM-type publications when it comes to, so for example, Lenny Ruchitsky's newsletter, or what Suresh Doshi writes on Twitter, just to get perspective from PMs who have had impact in history as to the techniques they've used in their careers, how they've been effective. I think that's always helpful context. But I don't spend too much time reading professional things, to be frank with you. I much prefer to read fiction for my own interest, read news to keep track of the world. I try to have very clear separation between when I'm working, focused on work stuff, versus personal life and stuff I chase in personal mm-hmm. life. I don't spend my personal time doing work stuff or even reading work adjacent stuff, to be frank.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's always good to, give your brains a rest. And then because we are always in this very logical space. So I think reading fiction is a great way for us to have better understanding of human and the world.
Yeah.
So now you collaborate a lot with data scientists. What are some common mistakes you see data scientists make when they collaborate with product managers?
Yeah, so a lot of the time it boils down to how experienced data scientists are in terms of working with a key business goal in mind. A lot of times people who are newer to the industry or people who are more used to working in computer research environments are less used to having timelines put on their work or making sure that their model is deployable, it's not too complex, mm-hmm. or it meets, say, latency requirements or their business needs, like, say, the overall inference cost and from a dollar's perspective, right? So I think getting familiar with those real-world considerations and keeping those trade-offs in mind when you're doing your development process, if you're new to the industry or new to these more business-specific ML-type roles, that's a learning curve that a lot of scientists have to go through. So that's something to keep in mind. And the other consideration is a lot of the time you have ML scientists that transition into the role from data science and analytics roles where they are familiar with the business stuff or familiar with the working world, but they're newer to ML stuff. They don't necessarily have that solid math or stats foundation. A lot of them could benefit from focusing on those core foundational skills, learning the math and stats as best they can before they dive into just doing the ML work. Mm. Because I know career transitions are attractive to a lot of people. Going into a more specialized field is attractive, but I care a lot about fundamentals, doing things the right way, simply learning applications, like learning how to use Python or use scikit-learn or use PyTorch. Using tools is much less fundamental, much less important of a skill than understanding the core math and stats first. Then if you understand those fundamentals first, tools you can pick up easily. It's like, it's a little like learning a language. It's just semantics, right? Mm-hmm. So I'd say even if you're transitioning to an industry, even though I understand tool skills are more marketable or you can pass the interviews that way, focus on learning the core fundamental skills, the math, the stats. And then after you get the fundamentals down, then you learn the tools. That's how you can get better as a core scientist doing ML modeling work.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's my little soapbox spiel.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of data scientists are on the team where there's no PM to support them. And they have to wear the PM hat to drive adoption of their data science products. So what are some useful product management principles that you think data scientists can adopt in their day-to-day work?
I think the most important principle would be prioritization, as in you have a limited amount of time at work. You should really set boundaries such that you don't spend all your time working because the amount of work to do is never ending. So in the amount of time you have at work, how can you use it to have the most leverage in terms of your own career development goals, the goals of your organization, of your manager, of the business area you're working on? Find the alignment or the intersection between those different stakeholders' goals and focus your time there so you have the biggest impact in the time you spend. That's how you can make the most of what you're doing and accomplish your goals.
Yeah. And what do you think about the future of machine learning?
So I'd say that machine learning, like I said, it's a buzzword. Many people don't properly understand it. The capabilities of ML in the real world are so limited by the quality of data that we have at our disposal. So a lot of the fancier generative models like DALL-E and so forth that you see getting all the press are quite difficult to use for practical real-world applications, simply since the data sets you need to power such complex models, as well as the compute costs and inference time needed to use them, are so high that they don't work for real-world business applications. So I say that while those state-of-the-art technologies are really cool and I'm excited to see what other state-of-the-art models come out of it, a lot of the ML transformation industry today focus on simply data quality, data availability, cleaning up data. How can we best use ML models to deliver real-world business value and also in a way that's interpretable or that's understandable to non-technical stakeholders or even visible to regulators so that they understand what's happening, that ML isn't a black box? So overall, I'd say the future of ML is all about interpretability, explainability, and data quality, data cleaning, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So not glamorous, not fancy, but that's how you get the real business value from ML models. But while I say all that, I see the state-of-the-art stuff. I think it's super cool. I have a soft spot for hardcore research, so I care about that too.
Yeah. And how do you see your career grow?
Yeah. So I just, every day, I want to keep learning. I want to keep getting better and getting feedback from the people around me. I like working on complex problem spaces where I can use my technical knowledge to drive a core business outcome. So I always do want to be responsible for a core business outcome, like, say, generating revenue or something like that. I don't want to be in, say, an internal tool space, for example. So I just want to keep growing my scope as an IC and eventually become an IC at the highest possible IC level where I can have this product authority over a very broad and ambiguous space. Mm. So I'm interested definitely in remaining an IC and having more product scope as opposed to scaling myself and becoming manager and hiring managers and hiring other PMs under me, since I want to focus on the product complexities versus the HR people manage complexities. Mm.
Yeah, that's very smart. And what is something you think a lot about these days? What's your recent obsession?
Yeah, recent obsession. So I'd say that this year I've been traveling quite a bit where I've always enjoyed traveling. I traveled quite a bit in my prior with the ML Solutions Lab. Last year, of course, we were all kind of coming out of COVID. Other countries were more locked down, couldn't travel as much as I wanted internationally, especially. So this year I've been kind of catching up on that. So I've been doing a lot more of that than I did before, doing quite a bit of fine dining as well, trying new nice restaurants in different parts of the world, different cuisines. So yeah, that's been fun so far.
Yeah. Well, this has been really fun. And thanks for sharing your journey, career advice, and best practices. So if folks want to connect with you, where can they find you on the internet?
Yeah. So unlike Daliana, I'm not an influencer. I don't spend much time on social media or anything like that, but I am indeed on LinkedIn. So you can look me up. Typically, if I haven't worked with you before, I may not accept your connection request. I hope you can understand that, but always happy to chat with folks and see what else is going on.
Awesome. Before we wrap up, are there anything else you want to share with the audience?
Yeah, nothing much. But Daliana, thank you so much for having me. I don't make a habit of talking about myself. It's certainly a new experience for me, but I hope that of all my bloviating, some of it was helpful and that folks can benefit from it.
Yeah, I think those are great information for our audience.
Sounds great.
Thank you.